regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be doing something a little bit different today. We're not going to have a armed citizen story or a good deed of the day or a citizen's report. We're going to focus exclusively, on the Supreme Court's oral arguments in Wolford versus Lopez, which took place Tuesday morning. A pretty beefy session there. Started around a little bit after 10 o'clock, wrapped up a little bit after noon. And I feel pretty good about a 6-3 decision in favor of the plaintiffs. I don't think we're going to get any of the liberal justices to jump on board here. And just kind of going through the oral arguments, I want to talk about the liberal justices and their line of questioning, right? It's not always possible to get a sense of where the court stands just based on questions, but I think in this case, yeah, we can read some tea leaves. And Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan and Justice Jackson, actually all three of them, raising arguments that suggest that they are, in line with what the state of Hawaii is arguing. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, for instance, repeatedly questioning Alan Beck, who represents the individual plaintiffs, as well as Deputy Solicitor General Sarah Harris, who took part on the side of the plaintiffs as well in oral arguments, asking why this case even implicated the Second Amendment. In fact, at one point, Justice Jackson specifically said, this case does not implicate the Second Amendment. It is exclusively, in her view, about property rights, even though Hawaii's law doesn't ban everybody from walking onto private property that's open to the public without the express consent of the owner. In fact, as Beck and Harris pointed out, law is silent about people carrying machetes. The law is silent about people carrying nunchucks or any other number of weapons. The law is specifically confined to those who possess a concealed carry permit, those who have a concealed firearm, and those are the individuals who cannot set foot onto private property open to the public without the express consent of the property owner. I don't think that Justice Jackson's argument is going to sway any of the conservative majority into believing that somehow this case has nothing to do with the Second Amendment whatsoever. Justice Neil Gorsuch actually specifically pushed back against that in his own comments, noting that the courts don't allow property rights to be defined in a way that would infringe on the constitutional rights, on other constitutional rights that we possess. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, meanwhile, seemed like she wanted to completely disregard the Supreme Court's text, history, and tradition test laid out explicitly in Bruin. She kept suggesting over the oral arguments that Hawaii's culture of not carrying firearms in public should somehow trump this national tradition of bearing arms in publicly accessible places. Beck and Harris, but Beck was up first, repeatedly pushed back on that, noting again that the Bruin decision talks about a national tradition. But Sotomayor and I would assume the other two progressives on the court want to rewrite the Bruin test so that it's not talking about a national tradition of gun ownership, but instead maybe a regional tradition, or maybe a state-specific tradition, or maybe, in the case of Hawaii, a tradition that applies when a territory wasn't a particular state, right? When it was an independent kingdom, that somehow those cultural markers should carry more weight than the text of the Constitution itself, and certainly how that right to keep and bear arms has been exercised since 1791 and even really before then. Justice Jackson also argued that one of the laws, well, she argued that all of the laws cited by Hawaii should be deemed as part of the national tradition. But specifically, there was a lot of discussion from both the conservative wing of the court and the progressive wing of the court about one of the laws in particular that the state of Hawaii cited. This was an 1865 law that was put in effect before Louisiana was readmitted to the Union. It's part of the infamous Black Codes, although it was written in a way that was racially neutral. It was not enforced in a way that was racially neutral, but it was written in a way that was racially neutral. And it forbade carrying arms onto plantation property without the express permission of the plantation owner. That that law and a 1771 New Jersey statute that forbade carrying arms onto improved land without a property owner's permission, those were the only two historic analogs that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals accepted as valid that Hawaii had offered to the court. In fact, the Ninth Circuit called those laws dead ringers for Hawaii's default prohibition on carrying on all private property open to the public. Justice Gorsuch wondered why we should look at this 1865 law, why we should not consider it to be an outlier. Justice Jackson also talked about the Black Codes. And I thought it was interesting. Sarah Harris, again, arguing for the Department of Justice, said the law's an outlier. And when we were talking about a national tradition of gun ownership, outliers don't count. They should be disregarded. Justice Jackson asked her, okay, well, why is this an outlier? She said, because it's unconstitutional. And unconstitutional laws, by default, would be considered outliers, right? Justice Gorsuch, again, wanted to ask Neil Cotyill, who was the attorney representing Hawaii, a former deputy solicitor general, about relying so heavily on the 1865 Louisiana law, which, again, part of the Black Codes. Cotyill said, well, that was a shameful part of American history. But he argued that it should be considered a part of the national tradition because the law was presumptively constitutional at the time, because Louisiana was admitted to the Union. Some portions of the Black Codes were struck down, but that law was allowed to remain in place. Again, the law was written in a racially neutral fashion. It was not applied in a racially neutral fashion. So it may well have been that the 1868 Congress could not find any legal fault with the way it was written, but that doesn't mean that there was not fault found with the way that law was administered. But even then, again, we're talking about an outlier statute, right? That law from 1865, the New Jersey law from 1771. Cotyill brought up a couple of other laws that the Ninth Circuit had disregarded. I think there was like a 1763 law from New York. He contends that there were four laws at the time of the founding in 1791, laws in four different states, that he says are similar to Hawaii's default law. I think Alan Beck did a good job of pointing out the lack of a historical analogy here, that the why for those statutes were very different than the why for Hawaii's statute, for one. And then the how was different as well. None of the laws in question specifically forbade carrying onto all private property open to the public, right? Most of these laws, again, were specifically and explicitly anti-poaching laws. Alan Beck noted that, in fact, I think it was the 1771 New Jersey law, had an exception for carrying firearms in self-defense. And yet, again, this was deemed to be a dead ringer to Hawaii's law by the Ninth Circuit, when in fact it is anything but. The reason for the 1771 New Jersey law differs than the reason for Hawaii's vampire rule, the reason for Louisiana's a law forbidding carrying arms on the plantations differed than the reason for Hawaii's law banning lawful concealed carry on all private property open to the public by default. Cotyill also, I don't think, did himself any favors by claiming that Hawaii takes the Bruin decision really seriously. And in fact, the law was written in such a way as to ensure that people's Second Amendment rights were protected. Kyle noted that, I think he said last year, state of Hawaii issued more than 2,000 concealed carry permits. Oh, my goodness gracious. What an accomplishment. Now, prior to 2022, the state of Hawaii issued zero concealed carry permits. So I don't believe that the state of Hawaii or Hawaii lawmakers suddenly saw the scales drop from their eyes after Bruin, and oh my God, it is a real right after all. No. Alan Beck has been very successful in challenging other laws in place in Hawaii regarding the acquisition of firearms, regarding the storage of firearms, and the licensing process in Hawaii is so restrictive that it is clearly designed to prevent people from exercising their right to keep and bear arms, as is the vampire rule. When Hawaii was told you can't deny somebody a permit because you don't think the reason to carry is good enough, you don't think they've demonstrated a justifiable need, then lawmakers said, okay, if we can't limit the number of permits that are out there, at least not in the way that we were before, denying outright everybody who applied, then we're going to make it impossible for those people with permits to carry anywhere. Beck noted that under the totality of Hawaii's a Bruin response bill, which included not only this vampire rule, but a number of explicitly sensitive places. About 96.4% of the state of Hawaii says is off limits to lawful carry. The progressive justices, I think it was Justice Jackson, might have been Justice Kagan, who kind of pushed back on that and said, okay, but that's with all of the laws here, right? Not just the default law. And Beck conceded, yeah, that's true. But that is the only law that is in question right now. And again, when you're talking about banning by default lawful concealed carry and all private property open to the public, that might not encompass 96.4% of the entire land area of Hawaii, but it encompasses 100% of retail establishments in the state of Hawaii. It encompasses 100% of those properties that, again, are privately owned but are open to the public. Not just 96.4%, 100%. Cagle also got a lot of pushback from the conservative wing of the court when he asserted that the Bruin test is not as simple as the court says. Essentially, Cagle argued that the first step of the Bruin test, which is, does this law implicate the Second Amendment? Cagle said, well, you got to look at history when answering that question. Because if you don't look at history when answering that question, well, then any law having anything to do with firearms could be called into question. And it would be up for the government to provide an affirmative defense that, yes, there is a historical tradition for these regulations. And that's not the way the test should be. Both Justice Brett Kavanaugh and Justice Amy Coney Barrett said, no, actually, that is what we have said. Step one, does this particular law implicate the right to keep and bear arms? Justice Barrett said, look, maybe if we're talking about trying to define arms, you can engage in some sort of historical analysis of step one. But other than that, it's pretty plain and simple. If the law implicates the right to keep and bear arms, then you move to step two. And step two requires the government, whatever government put this law in place, whether it's the federal government, state government, I suppose the local government as well, it requires the government that is enforcing this law to justify that law under the national tradition of gun ownership. And Justice Brett Kavanaugh, on a couple of occasions, talked about what that national tradition needs to look like. He talked about these laws being deeply rooted, being widespread. I think we are going to get a 6-3 decision in favor of the plaintiffs here. And I think Hawaii's default rule is going to be struck down. And that's important. But I think the court is also ready, at least to some degree, to start to flesh out some of the specifics in the Bruin test, what again is that national tradition of firearm ownership? What does it look like? Is three regulations enough? What about three regulations that existed in 1791, but you can't find similar regulations in 1868? What about three regulations from 1868, but you can't find any from 1791? What about three regulations that may have been in effect in 1791 and 1868, but we're talking about one geographic area of the country? Do any of those things encompass a national tradition? And based on what Brett Kavanaugh said, the answer would be no. That what you need to see and what the government needs to prove is that there were analogous laws that were widespread. So again, existing in multiple parts of the country that were deeply rooted. So they didn't just exist for a year or two, maybe even a decade or two before they were struck down. And maybe even that these laws needed to have been enforced. It's not enough that they were on the books. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were deeply rooted, but that they were an active part of the laws that people lived by in order for that to encompass a national tradition of gun ownership. It was an interesting oral argument. I confess that, you know, going in, I kind of I had hopes that maybe this would be a 7-2, 8-1. I didn't have a lot of hope it'd be a 9-0 decision, but I was hopeful that, you know, at least one of the liberal justices would be open to the idea that, you know, the Second Amendment, all of our constitutional rights exist with the premise that the default is you get to exercise them. And I don't think that any of the justices actually agree with that, at least not when it comes to our right to keep and bear arms. Justice Gorsuch, I think it was Justice Gorsuch, who asked, I think this was Alan Beck. He said, all right, so let's say you got a gas station by the side of the road. You have the expectation that you can walk in there without being asked to come in by the property owner? And I'm like, well, yeah, of course. Do you have the expectation that you can go in there and solicit, you know, drop off pamphlets without the express consent of the property owner? And Beck said, well, no, but you can walk up to the door, basically. Like, that's what the First Amendment jurisprudence has said. You can get on. You can go onto the property. You can leaflet out in the parking lot. But in a First Amendment context, you can't necessarily walk through that door and then solicit inside. I mean, frankly, I don't know that that's all that subtle. Maybe it is, but if so, it seems to me like you wouldn't need to see signs that say, you know, no solicitations allowed at you know, the doorstep of many homes and businesses. But again, in a nation where our freedom of speech exists, where our right to worship exists, where our right to keep and bear arms exists, I think you have to operate under the premise that those protected activities are allowed by default. Now, again, if a private property owner wants to forbid the exercise of those rights, as a private property owner, they have the right to do that. But in a free society, these enumerated rights should be, we should default to those enumerated rights being exercised. Because I think to do otherwise, and several of the justices talked about flipping the script, to do otherwise would flip the script, and it would flip the Constitution on its head. That, these rights exist on paper. But the expectation is you actually can't exercise those rights on any property other than perhaps, you know, sidewalks or streets. Unless, again, you get the express permission of the property owner beforehand. That's not how our society operates in a First Amendment context. And it shouldn't be how our society operates in a Second Amendment context. I think to do so does relegate the Second Amendment to second-class status. So all in all, I think it was a pretty encouraging day for gun owners at the Supreme Court. I think not only again, are we likely to have a decision later this year that strikes down Hawaii's vampire rule, but I think that we're going to get a decision that will implicate perhaps some other sensitive places, or at least lay out the some of the parameters of the Texas history and tradition test that's used to justify these modern day gun free zones. And I don't think it is going to be as easy as saying, well, you had this law in New Jersey in the 1700s, you had this law in Louisiana in the 1860s, and that's enough to suffice for a national tradition. I don't think that's going to be the case. So I am cautiously optimistic about that. It's worth noting as well that we did have an orders list released by the Supreme Court today, just before the oral arguments began in Wolford versus Lopez. There were no new Second Amendment grants. There were a number of challenges to various parts of Section 922G, the prohibition on gun ownership for, people convicted of a crime punishable more than a year in prison, people convicted of possessing a gun as an unlawful user of drugs. I think most of the challenges actually were 922G1 challenges, and those challenges were denied outright. With at least one exception, the case of Melinda Vincent, the court did not grant cert, the court did not deny cert. The court just kind of left that one alone. And that's interesting. Melinda Vincent, you might recall, is a woman who lives in Utah. She is currently a drug and alcohol counselor. 17 years ago, I think it was, maybe 18 years ago now. When Melinda Vincent was a homeless drug addict, she was convicted of passing a bad check to buy groceries. She has since very much turned her life around. I believe she received probation at the time, but it was an offense punishable by more than a year in prison. Nonviolent, to be sure. But she is, at the moment, barred from legally possessing a firearm. I had hoped that the Supreme Court would grant cert in this case. I have a feeling what's going to happen is her case is going to be GVR'd after the Supreme Court's decision in Hamani comes down. That's the case dealing with challenge to 922G3. But the fact that the Supreme Court held on to her case rather than dismissing it outright, I think is another sign that the majority of the court, at least at the moment, is leaning towards not declaring 922G3 unconstitutional facially, right? Meaning that there's no circumstance in which the federal prohibition on gun ownership for unlawful uses of drugs could be constitutional. But I think the court is leaning towards the point of view that's been adopted by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is that if you're going to deprive somebody in the, of their right to keep and bear arms, there needs to be some sort of finding of dangerousness. And that's what the Eighth Circuit has concluded. There were a couple of Eighth Circuit cases earlier in this session where the Supreme Court denied cert. These were cases that were appealed by the federal government. And in one of those cases, the district court actually went back and found that, no, this guy who was charged with violating 922G3 doesn't pose a danger to himself or others, and dismissed his conviction. That was one of the cases that the Supreme Court actually allowed to stand, right? That decision is what it is. It's final. And so even though Melinda Vincent's case is a 922G1, not a G3 case, the fact that the Supreme Court has held on to this, to me suggests that in Hamani, the court is going to say that 922G3 is constitutional, at least in respect to dangerous persons. But there has to be a determination of dangerousness. And they may rule so broadly that it would automatically implicate 922G1. But I think at the very least, the court is leaning towards, you know, sending that case regarding Melinda Vincent back down to the lower court and saying, look at what we said in Hamani and apply that logic to Melinda Vincent's case. So even though we saw a couple of, well, more than a couple of denials to other G1 challenges, I think it's interesting and worth noting that they did not turn away Melinda Vincent's appeal. The Supreme Court also took no action on Villamontes versus Cook County, which is the challenge to Cook County's ban on so-called assault weapons. Gators Customs Guns versus Washington, which is challenge to Washington's magazine ban. Duncan versus Bonta, challenge to California's magazine ban. I don't think it's bad news that they held on to those cases by any means. Would I have preferred them granting cert? Absolutely. But the fact that they have held on to these cases, they didn't dismiss them outright, to me anyway, suggests that the court is anticipating taking up a hardware ban case relatively soon. And by relatively soon, I mean when the Third Circuit Court of Appeals issues its opinion on New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and magazines. All indications are the Third Circuit is going to find fault with that law. New Jersey presumably will appeal that decision to the Supreme Court. They're probably under a lot of pressure by gun control groups to take the loss, like Illinois did when the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals said that Illinois' ban on carry was unconstitutional. Illinois ended up adopting a shall issue law because they didn't want to set a nationwide precedent. I think the gun control groups are going to lean on New Jersey to take the L there, too, if the Third Circuit says, yeah, this is unconstitutional. But I don't know that New Jersey's new attorney general will do that. And frankly, I don't know honestly how hard the gun control advocates are really going to push for that, because that would call into question, bans on so-called assault weapons all across the country. So that's going to be really interesting to see. Oral arguments were held last fall. Third Circuit could issue its decision really at any time, and I don't think they're going to drag their heels or wait too long before we see what the court says about New Jersey's gun and magazine ban. And I suspect that the Supreme Court holding on to these gun and magazine ban cases for the moment in the hopes that the Third Circuit will soon release its opinion in the New Jersey cases. And then those cases can be held until, the resolution, ultimately, of the New Jersey cases before the Supreme Court. That's a lot of supposition on my part, but if the Supreme Court were inclined to just deny cert to these gun and magazine ban cases, I think they would have already done so. So I think they're holding on to them for a reason. And that, to me, seems like the most logical reason to hang on to them. We also have the Seventh Circuit cases, the Illinois gun ban cases, and the opinion from the Seventh Circuit could come out at any time as well. But I think, given the makeup of the Seventh Circuit, given the fact that the Seventh Circuit basically overturned Judge Stephen McGlynn when McGlynn declared Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons and magazines unconstitutional, three-judge panel declared that opinion invalid. I don't have a lot of hopes that the Seventh Circuit is ultimately going to rule in favor of gun owners and our Second Amendment rights. So the court could be waiting for the first case to get up there, whether it's Illinois or New Jersey. But I think New Jersey is more likely to cause a circuit court split. And for that reason is the more likely vehicle for the court to weigh in on bans on commonly owned arms and including magazines, by the way. So there you go. The next date to really keep an eye out for at the Supreme Court is going to be early March, when oral arguments are going to be held in U.S. versus Hamani, that challenge to Section 922G3 and the unlawful possession of firearms by unlawful users of drugs. As for when we might see a decision in Wolford versus Lopez, you know, historically, Second Amendment cases have been among the last cases released by the court. So I'd say you're looking at, you know, towards the end of this year's session, which would be, you know, sometime in June. And I do think it's going to be a good one. I do. I hope it is going to be a decision that not just strikes down Hawaii's vampire rule, but a decision, again, that will provide more weight to the arguments that gun owners have been making about some of these sensitive places that are really sensitive in name only. And, you know, one of the other things I should talk about, actually, before we go here, one of the common threads in today's oral arguments was on the level of generality in terms of making these historical analogs, right? How closely do these historical laws have to resemble the modern day statute? And it does appear like the court is going to address that, at least to some degree. I don't know that they're going to provide, you know, a hard and fast rule that will apply forevermore. But, you know, in Rahimi, they said, all right, you don't have to have an exact twin, right? Laws aren't set in amber. But I got the sense from both Kavanaugh and Barrett that there is a desire to kind of rein in the abuse that we've seen in lower courts to the Rahimi decision by saying, well, you know, this law, you know, let's say a ban regulated the storage of firearms in Boston in the 1600s. Well, I mean, that's kind of like requiring background checks for ammunition in California today, right? That's definitely an abuse of what the court said in Rahimi. And I think that this case will provide the court an opportunity to give lower courts more guidance on the level of generality and the level of specificity that must be used when you're looking at these historic analogs. And again, just based on the comments from Justice Barrett in particular, actually, because she was the one that suggested during Rahimi that, you know, again, laws aren't set in amber. I get the sense that maybe she doesn't like the abuses that have followed and is ready to rein in these lower courts a bit. So it's another thing I'm keeping my fingers crossed for. All right. So that gets us caught up, I think, on what happened at the Supreme Court today. Tomorrow, we'll probably get in some reaction to the oral arguments in Wolford versus Lopez. Again, I think that Sarah Harris, the Deputy Solicitor General for the government, did a great job. I think Alan Beck did a great job. I think Alan might have been a little bit nervous starting out. I would be. But I think he did a very good job of explaining the plaintiff's point of view, pointing out and poking the holes in the state of Hawaii's argument. And I predict that when Wolford versus Lopez, the opinion is handed down, that Alan Beck is going to be on the winning side of this argument. All right. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the day. We are keeping you up to date on all of the other Second Amendment news and information from all around the country. And we will see you back here tomorrow. In the meantime, if you are in the path of this winter storm this weekend, get prepared, first of all. But if you're not, and even if you are, also, be well, be safe, and be free.